Welcome to this week's Reaction podcast with me, Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Reaction. I'm joined by Ian Martin, our editor, and Maggie Pagano, our Executive Editor. This week, we're going to be asking the question, has the government lost the plot? And just before we kind of get into the broader issues, Maggie, I'd like you to give your response to Rishi Sunak's measures today to shore up the economy. What's your take?
What's my take? I'll probably give him 7 out of 10. Two things really to say. One is it was evident that he had to do something. When the furlough scheme ends at the end of October, this sort of cliff edge thing, the pressure on him to do something, both from opposition, CBI, TUC, but also it was the right thing to do. He had many choices. I would say that I'll leave the chunkier bit till last, but extending the loans, 4 different loan schemes was right. Extending VAT to hospitality, which is obviously the hardest hit sector of all, they were all very good measures. Now, I have some serious doubts over this attempt to borrow from the Germans and indeed the French, this idea of covering people's short-time working. It's complicated, bureaucratic, and although he has done it to only target viable businesses, I think there's a lot of nervousness that it will keep a lot of non-viable businesses afloat, but also they might not use the mechanism. So it might actually be cheaper for an employer to just keep one full-time worker rather than keep 2 part-time workers. It's just very bureaucratic. I'm not saying I have the answer to what he should have done, but I think there would have been simpler ways. At least the cost to the government is not so great. They're paying 22%, but it's still £300 million a month. And then the employer is paying 55%, and the person in work will keep 77% of their pay. Now, is this fair on the self-employed and others in small businesses who are not eligible? Does it actually help the adjustment in the labour market? You know, there are some businesses that will be gone forever, but they might take this scheme up to prop it up. So they're my initial thoughts. He had to do something. He's done half of it was correct, although there are not enough incentives actually to hire people. He's got the Kickstart program, which doesn't seem still to be working properly. He's got the bonus scheme of £1,000 come January. But the worry is he's now created another cliff edge in January. Not an October one, but a January one. I would have also fiddled with the benefit system. Just quickly, if businesses are going to lay off workers, then they should be protected, and maybe income support and retraining packages. That could have been healthier. So that's my from the hip.
Do you think there's an element, I mean, we talked about this in early on in the crisis, an element of the Treasury being almost slightly too clever? Is there, as you pointed towards, maybe a simpler solution? What would that look like?
That's a very good question. I've been quite drawn to sort of universal income tax or maybe £1,000 grants per person. Now, that's unfair too, because there are a lot of very rich people who don't need it. But what worries me is that there is a big chunk of population here who won't get it. Again, it's, you know, somebody said it to me yesterday, free money for the union, for big corporate businesses. No wonder the CBI likes it. But, you know, the small little restaurants, small self-employed people, they're still left out. And they're going to be the next generation of wealth creators. So that's my fear. So could it have been, you know, £1,000 a month to every person in the country just to keep them tied over a couple of months whilst we see what's happening? I don't know. You know, I'd be interested in your view, but this does seem unnecessarily complex.
I think it's important to remember that this is not where he wanted to be. I mean, it's not where any of us want to be in terms of coming out of this crisis, because we're not coming out of this crisis. We're going back into the next phase. And psychologically, that has a very big impact on all of those involved, including Sunak himself, who looks, you know, really very stressed for understandable reasons, the weight of the world on his shoulders. if you went back even 4 or 5 weeks, September was supposed to be about something completely different, that we would all have been liberated by help out to eat out to help out, and we'd be back out there and we'd be back at work. It's only about 3-4 weeks since the government was saying, come on, get back out into town, otherwise you run the risk of losing your job. So it's obviously just deflating and kind of depressing, really, that we're going backwards. I think when I looked at the measures today, I mean, I had to read them 3 or 4 times, as well as having seen them in the announcement, but I had to read them 3 or 4 times to try and understand the calculation. There will be people, accountants, et cetera, listening who got it first time. I didn't. And my concern is a bit like Maggie's. I'm not saying I have the perfect answer, other than we need to normalize our economy as quickly as possible, because what we're doing here is, I think, just unsustainable economically beyond the next couple of weeks, couple of months. I just think we simply cannot afford it. But that it's so complex that I just have in my mind other, you know, reactions are a small business that we run here with the support of our readers and listeners. So we're a small business. We know what we're speaking of. And it's, me, Maggie, and everyone else on the team. If you want to access any of these schemes, you just sort of look at it and you can just see it's like weeks of work to just try and figure out whether you can apply for it and whether it's worth doing it. By the time you've done it, you've wasted time that should actually be spent on trying to do new things and invent new business lines and grow and survive and prosper and all of that. So I mean, it's a bit like the Kickstart scheme, which is very good. I have, if anyone is out there who has successfully, I hope I'm wrong in being doubtful about this, but if any Reaction listeners are out there and they have employed or know someone who's employed people via Kickstart, please get in touch. We'd love to hear how it's working. Because when it was first announced, sounds like a great idea. But once you get into the weeds of the details, anyone involved has to be on universal credit at the moment, at the point of applying, has to be 30 jobs created. So people are trying to find these clusters of other employers to join. That's all time consuming.
Bonkers.
And people are working in all sorts of small businesses and medium-sized enterprises around the country are working long hours and trying to get through and trying to live on their wits, which is fine, I think, for 4, 5, 6 months, the first phase of the crisis. But what's a bit dispiriting, I think, for people is that we're now facing another 6 months of it, which only takes us up to next March, and goodness knows, will it be finished then? Probably not. And it seems to me that we're, as a country, delaying the inevitable. And Sunak, to his credit, is the first person from the government to actually say today, and he's clearly fighting a battle within government, that he did say, we've got to learn to live with this. I'm not sure this is a package which actually meets that requirement that he's set, but at least he is thinking that and understanding that the rate at which we're accumulating national debt, the psychological impact on people around the country, the way in which the massive adjustment that's going to have to happen in the economy, that terrible phrase, creative destruction, and in creative destruction, it's an important part of capitalism, but lots of people can get hurt. But if you just sort of delay that process of readjustment, what are we doing to people? They're not then being incentivized to retrain, to rethink, to enter a new industry or start a business. They're being stuck in furlough, from furlough going down to part-time, what, a third of their hours, Maggie? Or is it 55% of their hours? I can't remember, even though I read the rules 3 or 4 times.
It's a third of their hours. And I was just thinking, you know, for many small businesses, let's take ours again. You know, what is a third of our hours? What is a normal working week? Some weeks we're working 40, 50 hours on Sundays. You know, how is a small business going? Are they going to sit down there and take everybody in the restaurant, work out how many hours? far better also.
While the incentive, while the signals from government are now, you know, go out and eat. No, sort of stay in. Don't be in the pub after 10 o'clock. That's naughty because you might be enjoying yourselves too much. So it's completely different from the message 3-4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And in business terms, it's going to be very dispiriting and really tough for people because I think there's something that's gone really badly wrong here in terms of the Tory party becoming disconnected from, I use the phrase, I like the Adam Smith phrase, or I'm not sure he invented it, but he defends it, commercial society, in his writing, this idea of, it's not necessarily a free market idea of capitalism, although he obviously didn't use the term, but that's the best way to understand commerce, the network of obligations and millions of individual decisions within a framework of laws. And that even when the Tory party's not been particularly free market, and its free market period was Thatcherism, that was an exception. It has always understood the importance, the centrality of commercial society, and they just seem a long way away from those who live in commercial society and try and run businesses. Maybe they're just trying to. It's just occurred to me. Maybe it's deliberate, Maggie. Maybe they just hope that small businesses, I use, you know, Reaction as an example, or other people I know who run small businesses, will just look at it and say, "Oh, for God's sake, that's too complex. Let's just get on with trying to do new stuff anyway," and then not apply for any of the schemes. Maybe that's the point. But what a waste of money.
That's my point at the very beginning. That's why the CBI and the unions love it, because the big businesses have got the geeks sitting in the finance office with loads of time. They can fill out, and they're the ones that will get the money, and not the job companies like ours. And there's one interesting point. You're talking about the free market. Ironically, paradoxically, what's happened is the government has closed down the market. I mean, the lockdown has said the market doesn't work anymore, hasn't it? Because it said companies can't function in many respects. So in that sense, because government by edict has said closed down, it should be, it has a moral right to therefore support all those in the market. But I don't think it's doing that through these measures. Not comprehensively.
It actually perversely, you're right, Maggie, turns into quite a brutal form of politics. And that's reflected in the way in which the public health aspect has crowded out the sense that we have other attachments and other obligations. Strong enforcement message, all this stuff also has, you know, as you just really interestingly outlined, actually, is like, has major impacts on how you view commercial society and our obligations within that. I mean, I thought really interesting what you said, Ian, about the strategy. There are three strategies I think the government could have quite reasonably adopted in March and April, even with quite a strong view of how of the kind of public health aspect. One, if there's what they're doing at the moment, which was outlined by the imperial in the text of the imperial model, which is the suppress and lift strategy, where you do quite strong suppression until you get cases down to effectively minuscule background levels, then you let people out again, and then you let things run up, and then you do it again. Now, if you're going to do that, that obviously implies like a huge amount of explaining and communication and targeted measures, because if that's what the form of the economy is going to be, you're going to have to tailor it very, very specifically. But they didn't actually explain that's what they were kind of doing, which now, given their lack of interest in creating a contact tracing system, which may well have meant that we didn't have to do that, seems to be the strategy. Or there's the third option, which is, you know, you would have been much more open throughout the summer and built up community immunity and all that. But that was a sort of half-assed thing as well. And I think I'm going on a bit, but...
No, not at all. Not at all. But your point there, Alistair, just occurred to me there, the Boris thing, what was it, flatten the sombrero, you know, the flattening of the curve. The thing at the pitch at the time was not, could we flatten this particular sombrero? And then if we do that, you can have a bit of time out. And then there's going to be another sombrero, and then maybe another one after that. And then, I mean, God, what is this? 2-3 years of this? It's completely unsustainable. But do you think they knew that and didn't tell us, or sort of hope for the best in September, October?
But that's what the sage, if you look at the documents, that is actually what they say will happen. If you suppress aggressively, then there will be a second peak. You will see it come back, and it'll probably, you know, and there's further points about seasonal patterns, which actually Sunak, really interesting. Sunak seems to be, he's expressing on the kind of on almost on the DL quite a lot of views which are actually quite subversive. Like in the briefing today, he talked about how it wasn't Eat Out to Help Out that motivated the spread of the virus. And he's right. Very little evidence to show that that it was spreading rapidly in restaurants. It's not true. What he did, but he said it's probably more to do with a seasonal aspect. Well, if it is a seasonal virus, then this idea that you flatten the sombrero is an illusion of mastery and actually a very potent illusion. It's stupid. So that's actually a very subversive thing to say. The stuff he said in the address in the Commons, again, so subversive when he said, you know, people were not wrong to look for meaning and to search for context and all that stuff. And if you, I don't know what he thinks of Matt Hancock personally, but the carry-on that Hancock has been conducting the last week and a half, it was as if people had lost their rights to do anything spontaneous that wasn't mandated by a wink and a nod from Hancock on, you know, on whatever politics show he's appeared on. You would get that impression a little bit.
Yeah. You're right, Alistair, and it seems, and one has sort of read between the lines of a lot of the cabinet discussions, that Rishi has always been the one, the more libertarian one, maybe moving more towards the community immunity than Hancock, Gove and Boris, who seem to me in the lockdown camp.
He's in a
much more intellectual
that's true.
It feels to me that he really thinks these things through and feels them quite deeply.
I thought it was quite systematic. And that's what was interesting about the address, I felt, because a lot of these measures were, I think, fairly predictable in their scope. But it was that shift in tone, which is like quite a fundamentally different perspective on what's happening. And we posed the question at the beginning, you know, has the government lost the plot? Well, you know, what people desperately want, as Ian said, is a level of predictability and a sense that decisions are carried through with a relative sense of logic, and also that the decisions that politicians make and their tone is developed with some degree of intellectual consistency. Now, what seems so interesting about Boris is that he's clearly listening. I mean, you've seen the briefings over the weekend about how he's, you know, he's had a meeting with or a phone chat with Anders Tegnell, the Swedish chief epidemiologist, who's obviously the poster boy of the anti, you know, of fewer restrictions. He's, you know, he has Carl Hennigan and Shanetra Gupta in meetings, who are obviously now associated with a really anti-suppression perspective. He's sort of got all these voices around him, and on Sage as well, which all the different members are coming out saying different things in the media, some of whom, as far as I can see, are completely out of order. And I don't want to be mean, but John Edmonds, who from the London School of Tropical Hygiene, his interviews in the last week are a disgraceful performance. And I really think if you are... the stuff he's saying about household mixing, about the obligations we have in terms of our relationship with disease, are nakedly political, and he should be, you know, the people who are expressing those views should be really accountable, because he's in the red circle politics, and once you go in there and say these things, you are accountable on a different, on a wholly different level to the one he, I think, expects he is being listened, on. So there are all those things going on, and then Boris at the centre is clearly just beating to his own sort of peripatetic rhythm he has, and it's going backwards and forwards, and he's confused and clearly exhausted, and just I feel deeply erratic actually, and that's just a recipe for real unrest and disaster in the next few months. But anyway,
on the Sunak point, Meg and Maggie, I'm not sure. I mean, we don't know enough about him yet and how he operates to know whether, to what extent that's true in terms of it, that he's thinking about this very deeply and intellectually. I think it's more instinctive than that, and he is throughout, really, you know, months ago, ministers were made very aware by him that he thought that the restrictions were too severe and that the economy couldn't take it. So I think he's thought that for a while, and he of course has the, you know, responsibility for the nation's finances, and he will see on a daily basis, he'll see the revenue numbers and get reports from HMRC and see what's actually happening in terms of money in and money out, which will be pretty horrifying. I would imagine, but it's so interesting to see him today. I think you're really onto something there, Alistair. This idea that he felt confident enough to trail a different analysis, even if it's not necessarily matched by the policy response yet. Almost an act of leadership, really.
Well,
now people are very cynical about politicians and think they game everything in the Sunak's position or a Heseltine position, that he can see Boris's, you know, there's a massive question mark next to Boris about whether Boris will be Tory leader in 6 months, a year, or at the time of the next election. I think it's highly unlikely that he'll fight the next election, actually, but we'll see. And Boris has been written off before, but there's this Tory void and this deep, deep private unhappiness and this sense that Boris was not necessarily a natural prime minister before this started, by which I mean take all the ideology out of it and the very big decisions you have to take, but that the job done even in an indifferent sort of mediocre fashion involves so much processing of paper, by which I mean intellectual processing, just the range of topics, the speed at which you have to do it, the amount of stuff every night, whether it be, you know, jumping from an intelligence paper briefing on Afghanistan to a paper on schooling to something on public sector pay to a report from the US, you know, all of that coming at you nonstop. But that's not really Boris. Boris is not a details person like that. And then he got ill and is obviously slower than he was and, you know, had a near-death experience and came back to work too early. He's a very competitive guy. So he looks miserable, but he's also battling to try and right himself because he didn't go into it to be a political failure. So I'm not writing him off completely. But in that context, and with the Tory party deeply concerned about what's happening, that subject I mentioned earlier, there's a Tory alienation from commercial society, the Tory party now being a party of the bigger state, competing with Labour for a bigger and bigger state. It's not really surprising then that Sunak would just sort of show some leg or voice some alternative view of the world. So it's you're right, Alistair. I think it's a very significant couple of weeks in Tory politics and Tory Tory history.
It's also to be more sympathetic to him. I mean, there's very little. I mean, this crisis is, you know, the crisis of disease and everything. It plays out on about on significant number of levels that are difficult to synthesize. People trying to reconcile, you know, instinctive fears of contagion and, you know, death, all these very emotive and powerful themes. You know, it's kind of a crisis, like, you know, that falls along a lot of different axes, with to be a bit pretentious. And you know, anyone, any prime minister, even someone with a systematic and, you know, resolute mind as Thatcher, I imagine would have probably found it difficult to navigate. But but that is, I think, where the sense of drift is fundamentally coming from, because it feels like every day there is a new one of the ministers, whether it's Raab or Hancock, whoever, you know, comes on the media and takes a line or makes a quite of emotive statement, and it's as if they're operating on a level of ignorance about what Boris really thinks about it all. And maybe that's how Boris operates, but it feels like no one's really singing from the same hymn sheet. So I thought it was, and that's, you know, with Sunak, why wouldn't you put your stake and say, well, actually, yeah, I've got a bit of a different view on it all. And it's interesting what you said about Labour. Starmer suddenly looks as someone who ran the CPS. I mean, a London lawyer, as he's characterised by the Tories, but, you know, he's a corporate guy in the classic sense of the word. He has massive experience running huge organisation, conducting demands, all that stuff. That suddenly, with the bigger managerial state, he's a sort of more appealing figure, maybe. But
that's why I think and Maggie, I just want to ask you just in a second about Boris and just where you think Boris is. But that's why I think the politics of this moment and what's born out of the crisis are so interesting, because you had going into this, you had already a Tory party, Tory leadership anyway, that was committed to a bigger and bigger state, a Tory party that's prepared to tear up state aid rules. And we won't get into all of that again. It's sort of Brexit related, but was prepared to do that on the basis that a Boris Johnson run administration would intervene and interfere in industry in a big way that previous Tory administrations since Heath wouldn't have considered. That was already happening before. Then this crisis happens. They kill the economy, or have to kill the economy in their terms. Just the level of state spending, the way in which just money is just flooding out the door. You just keep hearing it, you know, 500 million for this, 400 for that. They spent, what was it, 400 million on the one, it's nothing to do with the crisis, but it was Dominic Cummings' thing on the OneWeb satellite share, which might be a good idea, might not be, but extraordinary basis on which to spend our hard-earned taxpayer cash. So they create this the sort of idea of the bigger and bigger corporate state. And this suits Starmer perfectly, because that's where, I mean, he is, I would argue, if he becomes prime minister, would be arguably the most left-wing Labour person, Labour leader to actually become prime minister, in terms of his instincts about society and the economy and what the state should do and how much it should own and run. And in those circumstances, the Tories are sort of setting up really nicely for him, because he doesn't even need to make that intellectual argument. It's coming out of the crisis, out of all of that state-run propaganda, do this, go out, don't go out, come back, stay in, you know, go to work, don't go to work, funding, huge intervention in the economy under the guise of to protect jobs, just massive economic intervention. He doesn't even need to make the case for it. It's becoming the new political consensus. Then that means that he can next time frame the general election when it comes, possibly sooner rather than later, as a purely managerial question. That it's a choice which is, look, do you want the tired old Tories who are managing the new consensus, or do you want, as you said, Alistair, the sort of corporatist guy with experience who's run large organisations and who looks kind of boring but looks as though he wouldn't mess up? So it fits perfectly for him. So one of a Labour person texted me last night about precisely this and said, this is where he wants politics to be. It's a sort of new Butskillism with him as Harold Wilson, Mark II, and Boris as a bumbling Harold Macmillan sort of caricature person. So I think it's really significant what's happening. It means that Britain doesn't have an economically liberal party. Doesn't have any party that's, I mean, forget Thatcherism, but I just mean something more basic than that. I mean, fundamentally pro-market, economically liberal in a way that we would have understood for the last 30, 40 years. That's not the Liberal Democrats. It's not the SNP, which is for a bigger and bigger state and a bigger independent state. It's not the Tories and it's not Labour. This is a huge shift on a par with what happened. It's just a reversal of 1979. But Maggie, sorry, I'm going on, but I wanted to just ask you about Boris and whether you think he's done for.
Whether he's done for. As you said, it could be the father of the thought, but maybe we're a bit too early in writing him off. But what I think is interesting, and I'll sort of answer it by what you were just mentioning, one of the charges against Boris is that he doesn't really have a political philosophy. He doesn't have a sort of canon of thought that we can identify with. And I think most of his intellectual inspiration came from Marina, particularly the whole Brexit thing, you know, his very brilliant barrister wife. And I think he probably really misses having her there beside him to talk about ideas with. So that's on a personal level. So he's been cast adrift, you know, ill, new situation, and he's missing, I think, her to talk things out with. But he, in a sense, he's drifted towards a political philosophy, which is the old school paternalistic one nation, red Tory, even big state, you know, going right back to Disraeli and the origin of the political philosophy. And so maybe what we're seeing with Sunak is that this will be the shift in the party. That and also Heseltine, you know, he said it himself, hasn't he? That he's a Brexity Hezza.
Yeah.
But nobody yet within the Tory party is having this debate. But maybe the debate will be there and not between the two parties. I'm not saying we can have a split in the Tory party, but unless they all buy into this paternalistic big state. But I'm sure there are many of the younger generation MPs who are not happy with it. Or it's where the whole centre is a really, lot more German style. Yeah. Maybe we're more Nordic German. There isn't a debate anymore about state. Maybe that's 40 years old.
There's this weird theory around that, or amusing theory, that Britain leaves the European Union to become more European.
That's
the irony, that it doesn't leave and become, you know, buccaneering and free market. It does something else entirely. Don't think we know enough yet, Maggie, about what the Tory party can, the Tory tribe, the act. You can see what the Tory media thinks, which is increasingly appalled and waking up to the idea that the Tory party has been taken over by the forces we just described, or of very, very different economic philosophy or view of the world. What will activists think about that? I'd certainly tell you what a lot of Tory MPs are waking up to this, which explains quite a lot of the discontent. They're not, as Quentin Lett said in the Times, they're not actually that many of them speaking out in Parliament, in the chamber. Mm. But the way in which they're organising on the COVID stuff, I think that's a bit of a, you know, they're worried about, oh, they're annoyed about the draconian rules and government by diktat and all the rest of it. But I think it's a manifestation of something else, something deeper, a realization that, you know, quite a lot of Brexiteers who backed Boris are also Thatcherites or neo-Thatcherites. And they're realizing in the course of this that that's not what he, not what he is. Maybe they were taken in because he was a, or wanted to be taken in because he was an election winner, but he's, he and Cummings stand for something quite, quite different.
I think the Tories should also be kind of wary of this. I think at the moment, what people call the red wall or whatever, there's this sense that the Tories think they've struck gold with this new electoral coalition, and they've just got this relatively homogenous block of people who will vote for Tory now as a sort of, you know, approximation of their kind of statement of cultural worth. And it's about restoring dignity to the, you know, a particular view of patriotism that's been neglected. Now, I think that's, you know, voters don't actually behave in ways like that. And maybe that solidified towards the end of last year, but that was after years of a deeply weird and anti-democratic pro-Remain movement that really sprung up and has now gone. And Keir Starmer has been so aggressive in the way he's soft-signaled his way out of Corbynism and actually on the Brexit stuff as well. But they shouldn't bet on that remaining quite as homogenous as they think. And I think they may pay the price in the long term for not, because there was that thing we talked about last year where we felt that the Tory party wasn't, or especially Boris during the election, wasn't actually engaging in a lot of the debates. It was just kind of the refusal to engage reflecting, you know, we know what we think, and the other side of the argument is sort of ludicrous and metropolitan, etc. But not engaging will eventually, you know, shape, I think, politics and leave a bit of an opportunity for someone savvy and clever enough, which Starmer, I think, clearly is revealing himself to be, to make gains.
Yeah. What did you think, Maggie, this week of Starmer? Because I was so struck by the, I mean, the various, there's a lot of argument on the left as well about which bits of it were successful. There was the speech, and then there was the film. I thought the film was so audacious and clever politically. I mean, just really, just you couldn't signal it more strongly. And he's going to do this for years. The fact that he's praising veterans, saying "I love my country," so many, "I'm so proud of this country," as a rejection of Corbynism. Mm. It was really, really powerful. What do you make of him?
He's an enigma. I mean, what he's doing is very smart. And in fact, he doesn't need to, we were talking about it earlier, weren't we? I haven't got a clue what he really thinks about anything. But he knows which audiences he needs to bring on board. So he's sort of dealt with the anti-Semitic issue just about bringing Ruth Smith in. So he's sort of mending all the little bridges, isn't he? Using a word, patriotism, which, you know, was anathema to the Corbyn party. I would like to know what he thinks, but he doesn't need to tell us that yet, because he can just sit there and keep ricocheting with Boris, who he takes, you know, shots at regularly at PMQs.
Yeah.
He just sits and waits, doesn't he? He's the man in waiting. I take issue with you, Alistair, where you say he rang a big thing and it was very successful. I mean, the CPS has never really been successful. I can't think of one big. It's been one of the great failures, really, particularly against the crooks. And there are big questions about the whole grooming scandal, which, you know, supposedly he didn't take seriously. So I think there are questions about that. I wouldn't just take that as writ. But no, he's a smooth operator.
I didn't say he was necessarily successful. It was the fact that he did it for several years. I mean,
and
without, I mean, with Boris and the mayoralty, I mean, there are so many. There's just, you know, there's so many stories about him relying on other people to do almost all the complex work. Yeah. But as Prime Minister, you can't really do that.
But would you, but I mean, that's the reason you mentioned the phrase London lawyer earlier, Alistair. That's the reason, because of the way that it focus groups. That's why lots of backbench Tory MPs use the question, use that phrase after PMQs or on Twitter, branding him London lawyer. And you always get this with a new leader of the opposition, an attempt to try and define them and put a stamp on them because it's the old thing. If a leader of the opposition doesn't in their first 6 months, and it's slightly different because of the crisis this time, it skewed things. But if they don't establish themselves quickly as a credible figure who's heading broadly in the right direction, they're stuffed, and it's almost impossible to recover. Yeah. Problem which obviously William Hague had in after 1997 and 2000 and 2001. And has happened also with, arguably with Neil Kinnock as well, with when he became Labour leader. So it's a big thing politically that he has. We're not talking of him in any way being disastrous. He's got to base camp, which is that people are, and which is earning the right to be heard and listened to with a certain kind of respect. Britain has a pretty credible opposition leader. That's a big shift when you consider what politics was like 2015 to 2019. I think he is, as I said, much more left-wing just in terms of his assumptions about how society works. Is going to be fascinating to see is when it's possible to travel around the country properly, how he's received in those places where he needs to win. Just do they try and choreograph that, or is there, it does seem to be quite good at talking to people one-to-one, and what those people who switched to Boris or in those places switched to Boris or switched off politics and didn't, or maybe just didn't turn out, do they enjoy meeting him and think that he's got something, or does that London lawyer tag just connect? Because the reason they use the phrase London lawyer is, in focus groups outside London, the phrase London is a bad thing because it just suggests bossy person telling the rest of the country what to do. And lawyer's a bad thing as well. London lawyer. London lawyer as a combination means bossy person strutting about trying to order everyone else around. So that's why they're using the term. It doesn't really seem to be sticking. I'm not drawn to his politics or his kind of take on the economy or society, but I've been impressed just in operational terms how he's handling himself.
Interesting, maybe counterfactual would be if Corbyn by magic was still opposition leader. What I found very interesting about Corbyn is someone who made massive deal of rejecting fashionable liberal talking points. It was part of his politics is to be like, I represent a new vision of society that's not reflected in the mainstream. But it was pretty extraordinary with Corbyn. Every single time there was a what was broadly perceived to be a liberal talking point of the week, he would zero in on it at PMQs. And he had that little gimmick where he'd read out people's concerns. But I never felt he actually sincerely enjoyed doing that. He much more liked sort of going for this week's outrage. So the international law issue, perfect talking point. How can the government tell people to abide by their rules while they break international law? All these things where people go mad without thinking. Most people actually, and I thought the government was completely out of order, but most people think of international law not in those terms and not in absolute terms at all. And I think are quite sensible about it. But he would have gone for that. I can't even remember what Keir Starmer said about the international law issue. He played it so low-key. Maybe my memory's just...
No, you're right. You're right.
I can't remember what his line was. He didn't...
And do you know why that is? It's because he seems to have, whether it's genuine or entirely cynical, he or someone close to him has finally worked out how Brexit voters or not all of them, but how, and I voted for Brexit, how they think when they hear that sort of stuff. So if you're, I mean, I agree with you. I think the correct position is that governments and large multinational organizations bend and break international law and treaties regularly, but they don't admit it. And they try and claim what they're doing is within the provisions of whatever law. The stupid thing was to say that it was actually a breach of the law. I mean, that was just so thick. But if you're a Brexity person, I think, or large numbers of Brexit people, their instinctive reaction would be, give us a break. You know, honestly, seriously, are we going to take lectures from the European Union on sticking to the rules? I mean, stroll on. And he knows that. And so the trap for him to fall into would have been to be the lawyer and to go nuts about it and say, this is a breach of something fundamental. It's appalling. You know, we're not. And he didn't. And that was very smart. Sorry, Maggie, you were saying.
Sorry, I wanted to just whilst you were saying it. I read somewhere that apparently Brandon Lewis, it wasn't a mistake at all that he was actually very studied and calculated with that expression. Can that be true?
Sorry, I meant the decision to do it. I meant was a mistake. It was deliberate. They did it. No. He was briefed and told to do it. He was given the thing to read out. Yeah,
because they actually wanted to show that, you know, we're prepared to do this. Was it a sort of last little Brexit twirl, if you like?
Well, I suppose we weren't going to get into Brexit. Should we have a brief diversion into Brexit? At the risk of just sort of, you know, trying the patience of our readers and listeners. But yes, if there is a Brexit deal, it will end up being part. That incident will be presented by Number 10 and by Dom and by Cummings and the rest of them as a deliberately provocative thing done to shake things up and get the EU to take the negotiations more seriously and to create some movement to unblock the talks. I think they, even in their own terms, they went too far and I think nearly blew the entire process up. I think the government really wants, or not all of it, but I think the government really wants a deal, and I think Boris is pretty desperate for it. And I think that the stuff that magically leaked this week about how the trickiness of no deal and some of the measures that would have to be put in place, I think that was an indication that they want and need a deal. Yeah. I mean, I've never been that convinced that I've just never shared the fear that no deal is some sort of earth-shattering catastrophe. I think it'd be a bit of a mess, but a blip compared to what's happening with COVID-19. I know there was that new report this week which suggests it's actually no deal is more damaging than COVID-19. But that assumes that British government has no policy levers at its disposal for the next 20 years and just sort of sits there doing absolutely nothing, and that nothing innovative or dynamic really happens in the shape of the British or global economy, which I think is just obviously nonsense. So I think that really we'll know soon, but I think they really want a deal. Do you think there'll be one, Maggie?
Yeah, I do actually. I think, and they're sort of feeding it out. The state aid, they'll find a form of words. There is no question that they will. We know we have to do something. And as long as there's an independent regulator, I think we'll get it. We'll also do something wishy-washy on fish. I mean, I quite agree. I mean, tiny industry, a billion, as opposed to, say, the city, a couple of hundred billion. But I think they'll find a way of appeasing. It's only the French fishermen. It's within this 12-mile thing. So I think they will. They'll give both sides a victory. So city, some sort of deal on equivalence. We haven't got what we wanted, but clearly we know that firms can operate with it. They will continue. They're not all going to flee to Paris and Frankfurt. Fish and state aid. So there we go. I think it'll be done.
So some sort of deal.
Yeah.
Should we just, as a final topic. I know it's maybe it's a fairly bleak topic, just to go back to the crisis, but I just would like to hear both of your views on it, which is a question that keeps coming back to me, to which I don't know the answer, but it's, what is the crisis doing to us psychologically? I don't mean us personally, but I meant the country, the population. Because a lot of these new restrictions are, if you believe the polling, very popular. So people seem to be sort of simultaneously unhappy, but seem to actively want to be locked up. It's almost as though they've lost faith in their own agency. I don't know what it is that's going on, but maybe I just pose the question: where are we in the crisis, Alistair, and what's it doing to us?
I think it's a really good question. I mean, something that's just popped up in over the last couple of hours is the stats on whether people self-isolate or not after they've been tracked and traced. Something like only a fifth of people actually self-isolate, even if they have, I think it's with symptoms. And James Forsyth quite rightly kind of pointed out, well, the discrepancy here is, well, there's such strong public support for measures which are both transparently economically ruinous and also very, very authoritarian in scope. There's that. And then there is a lack of compliance on the kind of basic things that actually affect your life very acutely. And I think there is an element, and I've thought it for a long time, of a peculiarly British, maybe it's not peculiarly British, but I think it is something in the British character. There is a sort of venal hypocrisy going on. And it comes out in that essay by Orwell, The Lion, the Unicorn, where he says that British people, English people will, however badly structured the law is, or however ridiculous and absurd the rules are, British people, at the hint of like different treatment or unfairness, will completely blame the person and be, this is really unfair, and treat it as an affront. But there won't be the kind of, well, what is it about the rules that's making it more likely that those people are breaking it, or what is it about the rules that's generating my kind of instinctive aggression? It's just sort of funny. And I think it's this perverse, because we have a pretty singular and an amazing attitude towards law and the common law and all that, and there's those kind of very, you know, the sort of long continuities in our history that are really important. But then there is a kind of another attitude as well, and I think that's it's coming to, and it's also about class. And I think a lot of people talk, oh, it's not a police state, and I find this particularly from people who, particularly the certain columnists and certain people, sort of say, well, you know, even this lockdown wouldn't be like the first one, it's just a few restrictions, but without really thinking about how public measures affect people who are vulnerable or who don't have access to the same resources as they do, and they probably aren't able to be as creative with them as they are.
Yeah, and there's the added problem, which must write about at some point, about, so there's an obsession simultaneously at the heart of this in the thinking part of government, at the heart of the machine, with opinion polling and data. So this is, it reminds me so much of what happened in the financial crisis, the idea that you can immerse yourself in the data and that you will see almost, it's like kind of looking for signs in entrails, that it will tell you, give you sort of magical truths. And it's kind of how Dom won, that's how he thinks he won the referendum in 2016. You immerse yourself deep enough in that with clever enough people, out of it will emerge the sort of the direction and the truth, which other people are too stupid to see. So he's doing that. So there's all this data and a lot of opinion polling data, for which they're spending millions of pounds of taxpayers' money. But opinion polling is fascinating, but it doesn't give you foresight. The public don't have foresight about these things. Something can be popular, so you then do it, like sending kids back to university. But that then has unintended consequences because they're then back at university and then, shit, there's this thing called Christmas, so they better be locked down and kept at university. They better be sort of imprisoned in their rooms at Christmas. And it doesn't seem to ever produce this. People just seem kind of drugged or hypnotized by it. Whereas I had this moment seeing Jason Leach, who's the, I think he's, is he the chief medical officer or the deputy chief medical officer in Scotland, one of the officials, tweeting about this last night, because this is seems to be happening in Scotland, that they must, once they've gone to university, they must stay there. I mean, it's only September now, so we're actually saying we can pretty much see that in December they're going to have to be locked down and isolated from their parents because they're a separate household. And this is created by, this is law by diktat via statutory instrument with hardly any parliamentary oversight, either at Holyrood or at Westminster. And it's delivered in a sort of blithe, cheerful way by medics and scientists who've, over the course of 6 months, have just become used to their word becoming law, and it sort of become it happening by decree because they recommend something at a meeting, and then the politicians and the official and the civil service can then just make it law magically with no one having to debate it. And you just wanted to really say to Leach, just piss off. Who the hell do you think you are? Just the sort of blithe way in which this is being done. Track back 6 months or a year and said, some chief medical officer will be able to try and micromanage millions of people and their movements, 18-year-olds who are might catch the thing, but they're not ill. I mean, there are 124 cases at Glasgow University as we speak and 600 others isolating. I hope no one gets ill, but we haven't had any. I mean, how many of them are asymptomatic? How many are showing symptoms? Has anyone been hospitalized? You know, fingers crossed they're not, but all of the evidence so far suggests that they won't be, or not many people will be. But we just seem to march steadily deeper and deeper into this moral quagmire, and people seem to accept it. I don't know why.
But it's not helped by, as you say, and that's what I was talking about earlier, again, with, and I think it's something that's happened for a long time in that science, and it's not a, you know, this is a thing that happens in Western thought. The claims of science are privileged to an extraordinary degree and are treated often in isolation from other fields and are not sufficiently, don't recognize their own limits. And you know, this is such a Western thing, is to view nature as malleable to human achievement and to not admit that man cannot, you know, order in the particular everything. Yeah. It cannot do it to other people, and it can't do it to something like a virus. And I think that's, I was reading this brilliant passage, and I don't know if this is a bit off topic, from Hannah Arendt, where she talks about, in typically an observant way, the particular thing that comes from the Greek achievement is a view in the West as, again, nature as the universe is immortal, and that, you know, the gods are athanatoi or deathless. Mm-hmm. It's in the Iliads, and everything, all man's achievements come generate meaning because they're made by dying things. So history and merit and all these things are made by, you know, humans struggling against the fact that they're going to pass out, but that the world keeps going and they want to leave some imprint. Now, what's happened in the West with all this stuff around controlling the virus, and it's a war from Macron, and squashing the sombrero, is a perverse sort of after effect of that. And it's the sort of Faustian spirit where you just think that you're kind of, you can master yep. these things, and you can just push human achievement outwards, and it's all. But none of this is, you know, and a lot of scientists are not contextualizing the humanities and don't have someone being like, well, you know, what is the actual intellectual and philosophical basis for what you're saying? maybe you're speaking in a mode of thinking that you might not have might unwittingly be invoking, you know, a different inheritance, and maybe something that, and I'm just rambling, but there is a lot going on with the role of science in this crisis that is to me deeply troubling, and I don't think enough journalists are thinking clearly enough about where the limits of the claims of science are traditionally should be. Yeah. And it's all just treated as it's either good for public health or it's not, or it's competent or incompetent. But, yeah, you know, but it's political. So,
very well put, Maggie.
Very well, yeah. Added, I agree with every word you say, Alistair. And I think what really horrifies me, outrages me, and frightens me, is first of all, that there is no acknowledgement of what you've just said, that man cannot control. The language has been abysmal. But worse than that is that none of the politicians have been prepared to stand up and have an open debate about tactics or strategy. So I think that where we entered a path and we haven't got out of it was at the end of February, when the SAGE people, there was debate about herd immunity. We know there was debate. It is a classical hundreds of years old strategy to deal with disease. And even when Boris stood up this week, he's seen Anders Tegnell, he's spoken to Gupta, you know, these scientists are not in agreement, but he couldn't even acknowledge that there are different approaches. And to my mind, and the media, I have a huge anger with the way that they treated the discourse from March onwards, because they wouldn't allow a debate, the mainstream anyway. We've tried where we can, and so have others. And so the media sort of bought the line, and the fact that we're still not being able to, why couldn't Boris say, I spoke to Anders Tegnell, and you know, we all know the Swedish approach is different, but we've chosen not to take that approach because we think X, Y, and Z. Instead, you know, there's two balanced and witty, like puppets. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I don't know. I'm not a statistician. But even if they're right, is this still the right way of dealing with it? But we're not having that debate. And that horrifies me. End of rant.
Not a rant at all. But I think we're going to wrap things up there, because we've got to go and produce the reaction evening email and lots of other things. And get this, edit some stuff for tomorrow morning. But just before we sign off, if you're not a Reaction subscriber, which I struggle to believe, but if you're listening to this and you're not a Reaction subscriber, go to the website and become a subscriber, £6 per month or £60 for annual. You get my newsletter, you get all of the brilliant stuff from the team that's behind a paywall, and the price will be going up soon. So I suggest it makes sense to go and subscribe now in the next few days. But until the next edition of the Reaction podcast, thank you very much for joining us.